Hey, it's Bill Radke. You know, if you heard our Week in Review this week on the radio, then you heard us talk about KUOW's pledge drive and how important your support is. But for you, right now, the podcast listener, we're bringing you the show without the pledge drive stuff. So enjoy the Week in Review with no interruption, but realize how vital your support is. We can do the Week in Review because you support KUOW financially right now. Just go to KUOW.org. And thank you. Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour we spend together sorting out what happened this week and what matters and why. And we're doing it today with Erica C. Barnett from the CIsForCrank.com and Chris Vance, former Washington State Republican Party chair, Natalie Brand, political reporter at King 5 News. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Good to see you. So this week we saw another racist verbal assault, this time in Portland on a light rail train, and this time it ended in death. This was like your nightmare scenario of what can happen on a bus or a train full of there's strangers and there's disturbed people and there's anger and it's all mixing together, and this is what police say happened in Portland. The assailant, Jeremy Christian, boarded this train, started harassing two teenage girls, one of whom was wearing a hijab. He yelled at them to get out. I'm leaving out the profanity. He yelled, pay taxes, go home, we need American here. I don't care if you're ISIS, F Saudi Arabia, free speech, or die. All of this as he was taking swigs of sangria from a container. Christian made a sudden move in the direction of one of his victims who stood up, and there was yelling and then shoving, and Christian stabbed three men in the neck, two of them fatally. What is the lesson? We've read about it. You may have seen video of it. You've heard reaction from the mayor and others. What is the lesson to you from what happened in Portland, Erica?
I think the lesson, if there is any lesson, is that white supremacists have been empowered by this presidential administration around our country to, they feel emboldened to take actions like this. And, you know, I think we're seeing, it's not just Portland, we're seeing an uptick in hate crimes across the country. And this is just another example of this kind of action that the president did not respond to for three full days while he tweeted more than a dozen times. When he did respond, he didn't call it terrorism, which it absolutely is. He said it's an unfortunate action that shouldn't be condoned or something along those lines, something very, very mild and very much not what you would see if the perpetrator had been, say, Muslim and the victims had been white Christians, for example.
Chris, do you think it's fair to connect this incident with the way President Trump talks about Muslims?
Yes, but it goes far beyond Donald Trump. It was happening before Donald Trump. I think it would be happening even if Donald Trump had lost. It's really it's beyond unfortunate. It's horrifying what happens out there. This is the ultimate manifestation of this sort of attitude, but it's something I see all the time. If I go on Facebook and post something about the debt, I get a million responses saying, well, we wouldn't be in debt if it weren't for those illegals and all these Muslims. And if I post something about NATO, it's like, well, we shouldn't be over there defending the Muslims. And among just a huge segment of our society, there's now a general belief that all of our problems are caused by too many illegal immigrants and by Muslim terrorists. Those are real problems, I suppose, but it's gone way too far, and it's very prevalent. And again, killing someone is the ultimate manifestation of this insanity, but it's out there, and it is driving the right in this country now, and not just Donald Trump, but almost the entire Republican Party.
Natalie, what's your reaction?
It's just a terrible tragedy. I believe one of the Good Samaritans who intervened was an Army veteran. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I just, you know, obviously your heart goes out to the families of the involved, the two teenage girls. I know Portland is now, TriMet is having a conversation about how to increase security. It just makes you think things have gotten to kind of a crazy level, nationwide, worldwide. It's a scary time.
There was a rally already scheduled for Sunday in Portland, a free speech rally. I think they used the word Trump, like a Trump free speech rally, and the mayor told them to cancel. He said the First Amendment doesn't protect hate speech if it might get violent. And the ACLU of Oregon said, actually, the First Amendment does protect hate speech. So the rally is still on. Does anyone think the rally is legal but unethical somehow?
Well, I think, you know, if you look back through history, racist rhetoric, and especially when it's not checked at the top, when, you know, there's sort of an overall sentiment in the country that this kind of rhetoric is fine and almost condoned, it leads to violence. And so I think, you know, sure, the ACLU is right, and they've defended the KKK as well. They're right that it's legal, but I do think it's unethical to have to host a rally in your city and to hold a rally like this, you know, that has, you know, the kind of rally of which has historically led to violent acts. And it's not just people who are mentally ill. That was sort of mentioned, you know, every rally will draw some crazies. Well, that's absolutely true. But when you have a rally that's saying, you know, that's spouting white supremacy and endorsing white supremacist acts, I think it's completely ethical not to hold it.
Obviously, you know, if anybody's been paying any attention, they know I'm no fan of Donald Trump and for this wing of the conservative movement. But I do have to push back a little bit on the use of white supremacists. The folks involved in this don't see it that way. They think the rest of us are crazy not to see that the threat to civilization is coming from radical Islamic terrorism, and that our culture and our economy is going to be destroyed by massive illegal immigration. I don't agree with them, but they feel that way. And it's a legitimate political viewpoint that I don't share, but they should have a right to express that. And the other thing you've got to understand about conservatives generally is they believe that everybody's out to get them and everybody's against them. Big government, big business, big media. They have no allies and no friends. They're a beleaguered minority. And damn it, they
except in the U.S. government.
And damn it, they want to have the right to express. That's why they call everything free speech. You'd want to shut me up. You don't want to hear my opinions. And I'm going to do it anyway. And if you try and just use force to shut them up, I think you're going to see more violence.
Well, I don't think anybody's trying to use force.
I think saying you can't rally and you can't speak, that's the using force of the government to say you can't have a rally.
I think that's a very loose definition of the use of force. And I also think that when you say the conservative movement, that's mm-hmm. a broad statement. We're talking about the alt-right movement, which is a very specific branch of the conservative movement that does call for I'm going to call it white supremacy. You can call it, you know, anti-Muslim sentiment. But I think that they actually are endorsing, you know, a point of view that leads to violence. And that is different than saying, you know, as conservatives have always said, we're beleaguered, everything's unfair, we're the downtrodden, you know, silent majority. This is a different thing. I mean, if you're talking about a KKK rally, you know, if you're talking about an alt-white, you know, white pride rally, those are two different things. And I think, you know, to say that, yes, it is free speech is one thing, and to say we condone it and we want it in our city is another. And I think it's perfectly within the mayor's right to say, please take this elsewhere.
There's another rally that was set for next week in Portland, the so-called March Against Sharia. Instead, the group is coming to Seattle on Sunday, June 10th, and the organizer says that's because the Portland mayor made, quote, inflammatory comments and what we feel is an incitement of violence, which shamefully endangered every scheduled participant. How do you think Seattle will react? Natalie, have you heard anything about this rally coming here and any early reaction to it?
I have not personally, but you just wonder about this, you know, from a news perspective, the security on the streets, the potential for conflict, it creates a situation.
Mm-hmm. And again, I wonder if there's anything I do know about, it's about the conservative movement and the Republican Party. I kind of spent my life working in those realms, and this is not a small sliver of them. This attitude now is the I'm the one who is out of step with conservative voters now. This attitude of being anti-immigration and anti-Muslim and let's get out of the Paris Accord and Donald Trump's attitudes, that's the majority of the conservative movement, which is not a few people. It's millions of people. It's a huge segment of our society. And again, I don't agree with them, but they have the right, I think, just as much as Black Lives Matter folks do, to protest and rally and express their opinions.
Well, Black Lives Matter isn't categorized as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which this anti-Muslim group that's going to be rallying here is. So I think that comparing Black Lives Matter and whatever this group is called, Act for America,
March Against Sharia is the name of the rally.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's really a facile comparison.
Well, I don't know what group is sponsoring this, and I don't know exactly what the Southern Poverty Law Center did. But I think the overwhelming majority of the entire Republican Party would agree that there's a concern about imposing Sharia law here in the United States, which I don't agree with, but that is how they feel. And it's the biggest party in the United States.
About Pacific Northwest culture, one of the men who was stabbed in the neck in this Portland train, and he survived, he posted a Facebook video where he says the people of Portland who are heaping praise on him and sending money to him and the families of the dead men should focus on the girls who must be traumatized by this attack. He says those teenage girls are the real victims. And then he said that Portland has a white savior complex.
We in Portland have this weird tendency to continue patterns that we've done forever. And one of them is this same old, just to put it bluntly, white savior complex. Suffice to say, I think it's immensely morally wrong and irresponsible how much money we have gotten as opposed to how much support, money, love, kindness that has been given to that little girl.
Portland white savior complex. Does anyone think he could be talking about the Seattle area just as well?
I don't know what he's saying. I mean, I hope any rational person who saw someone who looked vulnerable like this young woman or these young women on a bus, he didn't stand up and do something about it. And that's not a savior complex. That's doing your duty as a citizen.
Yeah, I don't think he's saying that he's feels guilty for doing his duty or that, you know, that he shouldn't be given his due. I think he's saying, look, the reason we did this is because this is, you know, a group of girls who are victimized because, you know, one is African American, one was wearing hijab. And let's talk about them. The focus shouldn't be necessarily so much on these three heroes who defended them, but on the reason that they were attacked in the first place. And I agree. I mean, there hasn't been as much focus on the girls themselves and the actual substance of the attack and what the attacker said.
Well, part of that, all that being said, part of that, I think, is because, as I said at the very top, it's this nightmare scenario. Whatever the race of the people who happen to get involved, we all ask ourselves, what would I do? I remember talking to some people a couple of African-American educators who got spit on, and there were racial insults at a Starbucks. And the conversation was about, why didn't anybody do anything? And I've done interviews about the bystander complex. And, you know, here, which is this sort of social pressure to look around like, is everything going to be okay here? You're not doing anything. I'm not doing anything. And here these people and we don't know what happened, by the way. We really don't know exactly what happened on that train. But in some way, they acted, and two people are dead. And that gets people's attention. That gets people talking about what would I have done? What could they have done?
Given the tension nationwide, I'm just wondering whether conversations need to start much earlier in the classroom, among middle school students, high school students, just about what's going on, tolerance, how we treat people.
I think one really good reaction has been, or not a good reaction to this specific instance, but one thing that has been happening, a conversation that's being had, I think, is about what do you do as a bystander and training people to react, you know, properly when people are being harassed, you know, not necessarily expecting people to jump into a violent situation, but just, you know, just not standing by and letting people be harassed, you know, whether it's on public transit, on the street, or wherever.
And then the question is how. I've heard people say, go and talk to the victims who are being assaulted. Engage them in conversation, ignore the attacker, and that maybe de-escalates things. Every situation is different, and as I say, we don't know exactly what happened on that train.
So, again, I think it's important to go back to this, though. There are racists in this society. There have been people who have been racist throughout our history. That's going to continue. But for the vast bulk of conservatives out there, who, again, in my view, wrongly are acting this way, it's not about race. They'd be acting the same way if Irish Catholics were killing people in nightclubs in Paris, in Manchester. They are reacting because they're overreacting and reacting inappropriately to the reality that there's terrorism going on out there.
There's white terrorism in America against abortion clinics, and people don't react that way.
I understand, and you can rationalize it that way and say what you want to say, but if you want to understand what's actually motivating them, it's that. If it were, that's what is. They are doing exactly what the terrorists want them to do, which is turning this into a clash of civilizations.
We have so much to cover on the Week in Review. We're going to go to Paris, and we're going to go to Evergreen, and we're going to go to Soda Taxes and more. As we continue, we take a quick pause now with Chris Vance and Natalie Brand and Erica C. Barnett on the Week in Review. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review, figuring out what happened this week and what matters and why. I'm Bill Radke. We've got Erica C. Barnett from the CisForCrank.com and Natalie Brand from King 5 News and Chris Vance, still a Republican?
Just barely.
Hanging on. Also happening today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he thinks the U.S. will keep reducing greenhouse gas emissions despite pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Tillerson had urged President Trump not to abandon the deal, and Trump did it anyway. Our governor, Jay Inslee, says Washington State will continue to cut our carbon emissions.
We will not be dissuaded. Washington State is going to lead in clean energy, even if Washington, D.C. does not move against climate change. Good news is that we are growing jobs by the thousands in the state of Washington in the clean energy industries that are going to defeat climate change.
And here's Jay Inslee trying to turn Trump's we're number one rhetoric against him.
America, the country that defeated fascism, defeated communism, now has a president who would run up the white flag of defeat and surrender against this global threat of climate change is really pathetic.
Finally, Governor Inslee has joined the governors of California and New York in creating the U.S. Climate Alliance. They are committing to reduce carbon emissions at a state level, and they're urging other states to join. How much of this is local Democratic politics, Chris, and how much is meaningful action against climate change?
Well, it's both. I mean, if you're a Democrat and you're always looking at winning a Democratic primary, then being strong on this issue is huge. I think that the actions can be taken by some of the biggest states in this country and the biggest cities in this country will have a lot to do to bringing down our carbon emissions and protecting the climate. The decision made by the Trump administration is idiotic. The Paris Accord is not going to hurt our economy. That's why CEOs support it. The goals for carbon reduction are voluntary, and we set them ourselves. But it's way more than that. This is Donald Trump is bit by bit tearing down all the international structures that Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill and everybody else after him built in terms of binding this world together to try and prevent war. The United Nations, the European Union, the World Trade Organization, and the trade agreements and the Paris Accord. Trump is an isolationist, and he meant it when he said it, and now he's implementing it. It's disastrous policy for the United States.
Do you think this tearing down is temporary if a Democrat wins the White House in 4 years, or do you think
yes.
This is more permanent?
No,
okay.
It lasts as long as Donald Trump's in office. But what's even more frankly more scary is this is now becoming Republican dogma, and it did not used to be. Ronald Reagan was not an isolationist.
Yeah. Talking politics, yes, political reporter Natalie.
From what I've read, it would take until 2020 to withdraw. The agreement was largely symbolic. It was non-binding. Mm-hmm. So that's really the impact here is the optics. On the flip side, I wonder if it does energize states like Washington, California, you know, these green states to step up efforts even more, which is the messaging that we were hearing from Democratic leaders in this state and others to form kind of a green wall, as they were calling it.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 20% of the U.S. population just in those three states alone, and I think we'll see more of that. I think, Chris, when you say this is dogma in the Republican Party, I'm not sure you're right entirely. I mean, if you look at Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, didn't want to withdraw from the agreement himself. So, you've got part of the Republican Party within the state itself saying this is not a good idea. You also have companies like ExxonMobil, GE, not exactly what you'd call climate extremists, saying this is a bad idea. This is going to be bad for green jobs. It's going to be bad for clean energy. We're going to be at the bottom of the barrel, as far as, internationally on developing green jobs and clean energy. China's going to get those jobs. And that's not a good thing for the U.S. economy. So I don't think there's unanimity, even within the groups that you would traditionally
this
think of as not environmentalists.
Even Republican members of Congress divided.
No,
our nearest Republican Congress member, Dave Reichert of Auburn, says it was a bad idea. He says stewardship of our environment and sound economic policy are not mutually exclusive, which is what you said.
Well, so for two things. First of all, every time Donald Trump does something that's ridiculous and outrageous, members of the Congress say they're concerned and disappointed. They don't do anything about it because, and with all due respect, Eric, if there's anything I know about it, it's how Republican voters think. And Republican voters have changed. And believe me, having spent a year last year traveling the state, talking to Republican voters running statewide, they agree with Donald Trump on his xenophobic, isolationist, nationalist, anti-trade beliefs. That's why he won primary after primary. And that's why Republican members of Congress are under tremendous pressure. They might say something, but they never do anything because their own base will turn on them. And eventually, you're going to start seeing more and more Republicans elected who represent that base.
Some of the messaging, too. I spoke yesterday to Congresswoman Kathy McMorris-Rogers, the number four ranking Republican in the House, and her messaging was the United States is already a leader in green jobs. My question is, I mean, I don't see businesses slowing down their efforts to make, movement in on this front. So does it have any actual impact? I'm going to sit down with some green businesses today. And I think that their plan, especially if they're in this state, is to continue full steam ahead.
Well, my impression, and I'm by no means an expert on this stuff, but my impression is that China is now not only ahead of its own goals on the Paris Accords, but also is becoming the world's leader in terms of green jobs and in terms of solar energy and other, other things that we have long led on. So it seems like this is a step in the direction in away from that. Individual companies can promote green jobs, and that's one thing. But the government being behind it is a much different and bigger part of the picture. And I think if we're going to move in this isolationist direction, then we really are at risk of falling behind China on green jobs.
And eventually, though, the thing is the optics and the symbolism gets translated into reality. And the reality is the German chancellor saying we have to go it alone now. We can no longer depend on the United States. What does that mean? Germany remilitarizing? How would the rest of Europe react to that? I mean, have we learned nothing since 1945? It leads to China now working to rebuild the TPP without us. And China becomes the world leader in terms of trade. Donald Trump signaling everywhere he can, as often as he can, that the United States is going to retreat from its position of world leadership creates a vacuum that other people are going to fill. And oh, by the way, by saying you may not defend NATO, it maybe emboldens Vladimir Putin to move against the Baltic states. And then you have World War III. This stuff is very dangerous.
Back to the climate agreement and Erica's point. That's why Secretary of State Tillerson was in favor of staying in, because you want a seat at the table.
We're going to move on the Week in Review to what's happening in Olympia with the Evergreen State College shut down again today after somebody made a threatening phone call. We don't know what that threat was about. We do know there's been some tension and protests on campus over what students say is institutional racism at Evergreen. Here's the basic issue. For decades, Evergreen has had a voluntary day of absence. One day a year, some of Evergreen's people of color, students, faculty, staff, go off campus and hold workshops about racism and how the culture works, how they can help. The name Day of Absence comes from a play about a southern town where all the African Americans suddenly disappear. This year, with the administration's support, Evergreen's Day of Absence was reversed so that white people were asked to leave campus, go off and spend a day focusing on institutional racism and what they can do, and people of color can keep doing their work on campus. Well, a white Evergreen professor objected to this. Professor Brett Weinstein sent an email to the administration saying he likes the voluntary day of absence, always has, but that one group encouraging another group to go away is, quote, a show of force and an act of oppression in and of itself. Some students called that email racist and called for his suspension. And this is the sound from cell phone video of that Professor Weinstein being confronted by about 50 Evergreen students. And he's trying to explain himself here.
First of all, Day of Absence has been here longer than I have. I have never protested it until the idea. Would you like to hear the answer or not?
That last yeller there was agreeing with the white professor. He yelled to the students, "You're effing useless then. You're not learning anything. You're just making noise." So a bigger campus protest followed that, and all of this has gotten national attention for people who see it as another example of liberal students being intolerant of ideas they dislike. A Republican legislator from Ellensburg has introduced a bill to privatize Evergreen, saying the state can't continue to fund intolerance. What do you think this Evergreen incident tells us, Erica?
Well, I mean, Evergreen was created as a liberal bastion, right? I mean, it has a history of being a liberal institution. And I think that there's a larger story that this one little incident, not little, this one large incident misses about, you know, about the history of this day of action. I mean, it's a voluntary day of action where you know, people go and they learn about racial sensitivity on campus. And I think that that comes out of a history of, you know, of people of color on the Evergreen campus feeling that there wasn't enough sensitivity around diversity, that there wasn't enough training of professors about, you know, about how to be racially sensitive. And this particular professor has protested. This isn't like an isolated incident. He has protested sensitivity training before, has said that, you know, that it is a form of oppression against white professors and staff to have to do yearly sensitivity training and self-evaluations. That's pretty standard stuff, and particularly on a liberal campus. You know, I think that this professor is acting a little bit like the liberal snowflakes that people like him and Tucker Carlson, whose show he went on, decries. I mean, to say that it's a show of force for people to voluntarily leave campus, I believe it was something like, you know, 400, several hundreds of students who left. So I don't know that it's even necessarily visible, you know, as a form of protest that he would feel oppressed by.
Okay. Chris Vance, who's the snowflake here?
Well, let me just answer it this way. I have a whole bunch of different part-time jobs, and one of them is I'm an adjunct professor right across the street here at the Evans School at the University of Washington. I teach two quarters a year here at the UW. So I don't spend every day working in higher education, but I, for the past several years, I've worked part-time in higher ed. This is what everybody fears. I think probably just about, other than the most conservative private schools, just about every college campus in America is one step away from what we're seeing at Evergreen right now. People who work in higher education walk on eggshells and are careful every word they say, because now the student's sensitivity to anything and everything you say is so heightened that even a mistake can lead to this.
But what's the this? We're one step away from a bomb threat?
No,
or from
people yelling
at each other?
From students rising up and demanding people be fired. And,
well, hey, what's wrong with them demanding?
Look, all I'm telling you is this is the atmosphere that exists on our college campuses today. This isn't my opinion. Believe me, I know it for an absolute fact. It certainly exists at the University of Washington, where professors and administrators have to be very, very careful because students are like ready to do this if they sense anything that they really strongly disagree. Now, look, and college campuses have always been hotbeds of protest. That's the way college is. But this whole thing about there's too much political correctness on campuses, it's not a conservative myth. It is very real.
No, I do know some liberals who are, you know, fans of academe, who think that there's too much snowflakiness. But I think it's interesting to talk about who's being intolerant or defensive here.
Well, and day of action aside from that, why can't all groups sit down together and have a conversation about what they would like to see change in terms of, you know, a larger dialogue that brings the parties to the table to talk about it instead of, you know, isolating different groups?
And I think this professor, I mean, he didn't just make this, again, one isolated comment. After this happened, he doubled down and he said, well, why don't we have a conference on campus about the evolutionary biology of racial differences? That was in the email that he sent. So he is, in a way, inciting. I mean, if you want to talk about somebody inciting protests, that's the kind of thing.
Well, why can't he make a suggestion? It just seems like...
He can't.
We don't want students to demand too loudly. We don't want a professor to propose something we don't like. I mean, I can't keep track of the snowflakes. This is a true blizzard.
Well, I don't think that he. I think that he absolutely has a right to say that. But you know, I was in college 20 years ago, and we occupied the president's office over something or other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, yeah, and demanded that people resign. We climbed on top of a building,
yep,
and you know, hung a banner, and it was fun. And that's college. And these kids screaming. It doesn't seem that different than the college I
went to. It's not fun when you might lose your job over it. And that is the big threat now that professors face. I'm telling, again, this is not theory to me. I live it, all right, a little bit. And I remember professors when I was in school who would purposely say provocative things to start a discussion. You don't do that in a classroom anymore. You just don't, because it's your job. And the other thing, I don't know if this is true everywhere now, professors' tenure and their jobs are very much based upon student evaluations. You get bad evaluations, you lose your job, all right? And so people—
I would really like to see some numbers on that rather than an anecdote from a part-time professor.
Okay,
I mean,
well,
I don't know that
Well, Erica, go across the street, go talk to University of Washington administrators. Believe me.
That, again, is anecdote.
Okay, but that is how you're judged, is by student evaluations. And therefore, the whole atmosphere now is to— don't make anybody mad. Don't be provocative.
And we want our campuses to be provocative within bounds.
I find it hard to believe, and again, I don't have data on this, but I find it hard to believe that college campuses are sterile places where discussion no longer happens and where intellectual, you know, conversations are stifled to the extent that you're describing, Chris.
Maybe KOW will pay our tuition and enroll all of us in college, and we can just report back.
So I would love that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Back to school. That's kind of what we do on KOW.
We're wanted to go to law school, Bill. Will you do that?
Me too.
Really?
We can go together.
I want to major in psychology, in cognitive psychology. So can we
at least have already?
Can we kind of do every single day? It's Chris Vance and Natalie Brand and Erica C. Barnett, and we've got more of the Week in Review, figuring out what happened, how our cognitions process it, and what matters. Stay tuned for more Week in Review. KUW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, of course. We're talking about the tensions on campus at Evergreen, and AR tweets, let racists be racist. If they're not saying go hurt slash kill these people, let it be said. Bad ideas are destroyed by better ideas. And Sarah says, as a student at University of Washington, I've just about never had my beliefs challenged. It seems the instructors all teach the same extreme liberal point of view on repeat. Thanks for tuning in. We have our guest panel this hour, Natalie Brand from King 5 News and Erica C. Barnett, the CS for Crank.com, Chris Vance, former Washington State Republican Party chair. I've got some diet soda here. I just want to pour a little bit more so we have some good portions. I'll pass this around. We'll get into soda tax in a moment that was originally proposed by Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray. He's on his way out, but the city is still talking about soda tax. Let's start with who might be the next mayor of Seattle. Natalie, you're covering the mayoral campaign at King 5. What's the big news there?
Well, the big news this week is that former state representative Justin Farrell resigned from the state house to focus full time on the mayoral campaign. So that was a big development this week, just because it kind of sets up the race to be even more competitive. She was on a fundraising freeze. Now she can raise money and campaign full time. So I've noticed her campaign stepping up. Obviously, one of the other big front runners, the names that people are talking about, former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan, who got a big endorsement this week by the Chamber of Commerce's Political Action Committee. As far as the labor endorsements, those are still up for grabs for the most part. I know Erica was at a forum last night, and it's going to be a competitive sprint until the August 1st primary, and ballots go out in just a few weeks' time, really. 7 weeks.
Oh my God. August 1st? Is that really when it is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Go
down. That's the earliest ever.
21 names on a ballot to 2.
Do you think we have 2 front runners yet?
I think we have 6 candidates who have campaigned, who are running active, visible campaigns.
Correct.
And are standing out. And I could list them. I don't know if we have time, but Durkan, Farrell, Moon, McGinn, a former mayor, Nikita Oliver, State Senator Bob Haskawa.
Chris, I know you don't live in Seattle, but I know you follow this stuff, right? Any thoughts?
The biggest one is it's so difficult to figure out a primary like this. First of all, it's nonpartisan. If you have a race between a Republican and a Democrat, I can do some analysis based on data and look at, you know, how many Republicans live in the district, how many Democrats. In a situation like this, it is so unpredictable. Which one of these candidates, this crowded field, is going to catch the voters' fancy? What What do the voters of Seattle want? I mean, is getting the endorsement of the Seattle Chamber, which Jenny Durkin just got, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it cement her as the establishment candidate, and that's what voters do not want? I mean, I do not know. I mean, I'll look at the August primary results. Then you can make some predictions for November. But right now, I have no idea.
And during an off year, numbers were down in 2015. But in speaking to Jenny Durkin just this week, she said that engagement does seem to be really high at the forums, the various forums that she's been at. So I don't know. Maybe people are more engaged this year.
Last word, Erica C.
Well, I think this is ultimately going to come down to, you know, a couple thousand votes. When you have 20,000, or when you have 21, not 20,000, 21, all that feels like
it. Feels like 20,000.
Candidates, you know, you're looking at, you know, all those 15 other candidates getting, you know, a percentage point or two. So you're, the top front runners are going to be battling over just a very few votes. I think Jessen Farrell is in a good position. I think Jenny Durkin is in a good position. And of course, Mike McGinn has very high name recognition, having been the mayor before. So I think those are going to be the top three names. If I had to pick today, I'd say Jenny Durkin and Jessen Farrell would come through, which would mean that we would have our first female mayor in almost 100 years, no matter who wins.
Years.
Yes. In fact, a KUW listener wanted to know, why is that we haven't had a woman mayor in so long? And we're going to look into more of that. So stay tuned. I'm going to start this next topic by doing something I don't think I've done in, 30 years. I'm going to drink Diet Coke. I don't know what's in here exactly. I don't trust it, but... Mm-hmm. That is not good. So the Seattle soda tax has gone on a diet. And this week, the city council removed diet drinks from their proposed tax on distributors of sweetened beverages. No taxing the diet drinks with this new tax. And here are the two basic arguments. People who want to tax diet sodas say, well, they are more popular with people who have more money. Typically. So taxing only sugary sodas disadvantages poor people and people of color. City council members who just removed diet sodas from the tax say that artificial sweeteners might be bad for you, but we're not sure. The food science isn't settled. And if only the sugary drinks get more expensive, then at least you have a cheaper soda option. You can switch to diet. What is the better argument, Erica C?
Well, I have to say, as a Diet Coke aficionado and someone who would be very much impacted by this tax, because I also drink, you know, those sugary flavor waters that are just like absolute disgusting chemical junk. I think it makes a lot of sense to tax diet soda. I don't think it's a healthier alternative for kids to be drinking Diet Coke. And I think if the food science is out on, you know, on the effects of stuff like aspartame, the chemical that they put in a lot of these drinks, I mean... that is true. We don't know if it causes cancer. You know, there's no direct link. But I think we do know that it causes a sweet tooth and it causes you to want more sugary junk. I mean, there's pretty good science on that. So I think there's a scientific argument. And I also think, you know, none of these things are good for us. So if we're going to tax one, let's tax them all. Let's make it even-handed and fair and maybe just lower the total amount of the tax so that it's, you know, instead of 1.75, it's, you know, it's a little bit lower. Lisa Herbold proposed turning it into a 1 cent tax on everything. And that didn't go through, but I think that might have made more sense.
So you're not a diet soda fan, but you drink it because you're addicted? Oh, you are.
No, I am. I like diet soda.
You think it's awful, but you like it.
I know that it's awful for me.
Got it. Okay. Who else?
It's better for you than smoking, you know?
Can I be a conservative for once for a minute?
Sure.
Government is supposed to collect taxes in order to provide the services we all need, to do for us the things that we can't do for ourselves. Government is not supposed to collect taxes to engage in social engineering and drive us to make decisions because sitting in their big leather chairs, they think they know better than we do. Now, of course, we always do a little of that, the home mortgage credit and our income taxes, and we tax cigarettes. But this is PC social engineering run amok. It's silly.
How is this different from taxing cigarettes?
Because cigarettes kill you, okay?
So does diabetes.
No, okay. So let's just tax everything with sugar in it. It is just...
We could.
It is... Oh, come on.
There are arguments about that. Some people like who have drive-in theaters say, tax donuts too or whatever so that at least everybody gets taxed
cake
less.
And donuts just, and Twinkies. And let's tax
I just want to make a legal point here that we can't do that because that isn't measured. So, we don't have rules that
say this is why
added sugar.
This is why the rest of the state thinks Seattle's insane. Okay.
But why has it so? But Seattle wouldn't be the first jurisdiction to do this. They, I guess, from an article I read, six other places have passed this.
Philadelphia.
I agree with Erica that if one soda, if one variety is taxed, then the other should be taxed. Diet soda, I don't believe, is great for people to be drinking, especially kids if they're going to switch, you know. So, but what was the council's idea? I know that they want to dedicate this money to education, a health fund or education health.
Yes, to used to support healthful eating and education.
Yeah, there's a long list of things, but I mean, there's a mentoring program that it would support. There's education on, you know, on what kinds of foods are healthy. The city does have a department of education and early learning.
The city has a department for everything. Let's just have it the city of the nanny state that's going to tell us all how to live. It's crazy. Okay. It's not the role of city government at all.
All right, listen, we don't have long to live because we're hooked on diet soda, so we have to. I just want to say one more thing. My favorite story of the week: BMW's got a new car share where you use their mobile app, find the nearest car, unlock it with your phone, drive it around, drop it off. Seattle Times reports some of the cars were on Washington State ferries over the weekend, Bainbridge, Seattle, Mukilteo, and the boat started sailing. The cars sensed they were moving, but there's no driver. Engines are off, doors are locked, so the computers think, I'm being stolen. And they go into self-locking mode. One of them got restarted eventually, but the Bainbridge and Mukilteo cars had to be towed off the ferries, and I'm sure BMW will figure this out eventually. But for another day, it feels good to be a human who understands that we have lakes, and we live with sounds, and we live with ferry boats, and we know what we're doing for now. Thank you, humans. Erica C. Barnett, CSforCrank.com, Natalie Brand, political reporter, King 5 News, Chris Vance, still a Republican.
Barely.
Former chair of the state party. Thanks to you all. KUW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in.